All right, so you're at like a trampoline park or maybe signing up for like a 5K and someone shoves a waiver in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know the kind, right?
Oh, yeah.
All those paragraphs of tiny print.
Definitely.
You probably just like sign it without really reading it.
Most people do, right? You just want to get to the fun part.
Exactly.
Mm.
So question is, does that signature really mean you've given up all your rights to sue if something bad happens?
It's a good question, and it's way more complicated than just yes or no.
That's what we're diving into today. The limits of these liability waivers and what they really mean for you.
We'll be using a really interesting court case to illustrate these points.
Sweat v. Big Time Auto Racing.
It's a perfect example of how these waivers are interpreted by the courts and the kind of situations where they might not protect a company as much as they thought.
And this is important for everyone, honestly. Not just law students.
Oh, absolutely. We've all signed these things at some point. And understanding how they work means you can make more informed decisions about the risks you're taking.
Okay, so let's set the scene for Sweat v. Big Time Auto Racing.
All right, so we've got our main character, George Sweat. He's at a racetrack.
Big racing fan, I'm guessing.
Seems that way. He pays extra to get into the pit area.
Ah, so he's serious.
Yeah.
He wants to see the cars and the crews up close.
Exactly. Now, to get into this pit area, he has to sign a liability waiver. Pretty standard procedure.
Makes sense. I mean, it's a racetrack. There's inherent danger just being there.
Right. Think about fast cars, loud noises, potential for debris flying around.
Yeah, not exactly a calm, relaxing environment.
So the racetrack, Big Time Auto Racing, is trying to protect themselves from lawsuits if someone gets hurt.
That's where the waiver comes in.
Exactly. Now, here's where it gets interesting. The races are over. Sweat's been enjoying the spectacle from the pit area.
So far, so good.
But then as people are starting to leave, the bleachers in the pit area collapse.
Oh, no.
And Sweat is injured. Now, the thing is, the regular spectators, the ones in the general admission stands, didn't sign any waivers. Only the folks with pit access, like Sweat.
Hmm. So two groups of people at the same event, but only one group signed a waiver.
And that becomes really crucial later on.
Okay, so what happens next?
Well, as you might expect, Big Time Auto Racing argues that they're not liable for Sweat's injuries because he signed that waiver.
So their argument is he knew the risks. He signed a piece of paper saying he wouldn't sue.
Precisely. And initially, the court agrees with them. Case closed, right?
Seems pretty open and shut.
But Sweat, he's not giving up. He appeals the decision.
Good for him. It's worth a shot, right?
And this is where it gets really legally interesting. Because the Court of Appeal takes a much closer look at the situation. They start asking some hard questions about what that waiver really covers.
So it's not just about whether a signature is there, but what that signature actually represents.
Exactly. They're trying to determine the scope of the agreement. Did Sweat really agree to assume the risk of literally anything that could happen in the pit area?
And was the racetrack's potential negligence in maintaining those bleachers, was that actually something that was covered by the waiver?
Those are the million-dollar questions.
So how did the court approach this? How did they decide what was covered and what wasn't?
Okay, so this is where we get into some legal concepts that are super important for understanding these cases. The first one is this idea of the reasonably related test.
Reasonably related. Break that down for us.
Basically, the court is saying that for a waiver to be enforceable, the injury has to be something that's reasonably related to the activity the waiver was meant to cover.
So it's not just a blanket, I won't sue you for anything.
Nope. It's more nuanced than that. Let's say you sign a waiver to go bungee jumping. You're accepting the risks that come with jumping off a bridge with a giant rubber band attached to you.
Right. Like the cord could snap or something.
Exactly. But does that mean you're also accepting the risk that the bungee jumping company didn't properly inspect their equipment and the platform you're jumping from collapses because of their negligence?
That seems like a separate issue.
Yeah.
Not really part of the inherent risks of bungee jumping itself.
Exactly. And that's the distinction the court is trying to make in the Sweat case. Was the collapse of the bleachers a risk that was reasonably related to being in the pit area at a racetrack?
So how did they figure that out? Did they look at, like, industry standards or something?
They looked at a few things. First, they looked at the actual wording of the waiver itself. Was it super specific about Sweat taking on the risk of absolutely any injury, no matter what caused it, in the pit area?
And was it?
Turns out the waiver was pretty general. It talked about the dangers of being around a racetrack during a racing event, but it didn't specifically mention anything about the structural safety of the facilities or the bleachers themselves.
Ah, so it's almost like if you don't explicitly list a specific risk, it might not be covered.
It's a lot like that.
Huh.
And that brings in another important legal principle, contra preferentum.
Which
it basically means that if there's any ambiguity in a contract like this waiver, the court will interpret that ambiguity against the person who wrote the contract.
In this case, big time auto racing.
Right. They wrote the waiver. So if it's unclear whether a collapsing Blucher was a risk, Sweat agreed to take on the court will likely side with Sweat.
So the racetrack should have been more specific in their waiver if they wanted to cover that kind of scenario.
That's the takeaway here. Don't rely on vague language. Be clear about the risks you're trying to have people waive.
Makes sense. Okay, so we've talked about the reasonably related test and contra profferentum. What else did the court consider?
They also looked at the purpose of the waiver and the pit pass itself.
What do you mean by that?
Well, someone pays extra to get into the pit area, to have a closer experience of the race, right? They want to see the cars, the drivers, the action up close.
So the purpose is to enhance the racing experience.
Exactly. And the court reasoned that it's logical to assume someone in that situation is accepting the risks directly related to that enhanced racing experience.
Like the noise, the crowds, the potential for a car to spin out.
Right. But would a reasonable person think they're also accepting the risk that the bleachers they're sitting on might collapse due to poor maintenance?
That seems like a separate issue. Again, not directly related to the racing itself.
The court agreed. They said the purpose of the pit pass and the waiver was tied to the active racing event, not necessarily to the structural integrity of the facilities.
Interesting. And there was another point you mentioned earlier about the timing of the waivers.
Oh, right. The court found it really relevant that general admission spectators didn't sign waivers at all.
They were just there to watch the race from a distance.
Exactly. And even people who entered the pit area after the races were over didn't have to sign a waiver.
Huh. That does seem odd. Why would a waiver be required before the race but not after if it's supposed to cover any injury in that area?
The court thought so too. This difference in when waivers were required really suggested that the risks the waiver was meant for were those directly tied to the live racing activity.
So a structural collapse after the racing is done wouldn't fall under that umbrella?
Precisely. The court was looking at the big picture, trying to figure out the intent behind the waiver and how a reasonable person would understand it.
This is all super helpful for understanding how courts analyze these cases.
Mm-hmm.
But for our listeners who might be future lawyers, what are the key takeaways from Sweat? Like, what should they be thinking about when they encounter similar cases?
There are a few really important legal principles that Sweat highlights. First off, the concept of express assumption of risk.
Okay, break that one down for us.
Essentially, for a liability waiver to hold up in court, it needs to clearly state the risks the person is agreeing to take on. No vague language, no general statements. It has to be specific.
So just saying you assume all risks isn't good enough?
Not really. It might work in some situations, but if there's an unexpected type of negligence involved, the court might find that the waiver didn't actually cover that specific risk.
Like with the collapsing bleachers.
Exactly. The second principle is the causal connection test, which we talked about earlier. The negligence that causes the injury has to be connected to the activity for which the waiver was signed.
So you can't just sign a waiver for one thing and then expect it to cover something completely unrelated.
Right. It has to be a logical connection between the waiver, the activity, and the injury.
And finally, there's the public policy angle.
Right. Courts are generally hesitant to let organizations completely escape liability for their own negligence just because someone signed a waiver.
Especially if the waiver wasn't crystal clear about what those risks were.
Exactly. There's a sense that you can't just contract away your responsibility to provide a reasonably safe environment unless you are super explicit about what people are waiving.
So Sweat is a good reminder that these waivers aren't always ironclad guarantees.
Not at all. They have their limitations.
Right.
And courts will look closely at the specific facts of each case to make sure they're being used fairly.
So for anyone listening who might be drafting contracts or agreements someday, what's the big lesson from Sweat?
Be specific. Don't use vague catch-all phrases. Really think about the potential dangers involved in whatever activity you're dealing with and list them clearly in the waiver.
If you want it to cover something, spell it out. Don't leave it open to interpretation.
Right, because as Sweat shows us, courts are more likely to side with the person who was injured if the waiver is unclear.
They want to protect people from unknowingly assuming risks they didn't actually agree to.
Exactly. So yeah, big takeaway, be clear, be specific, and make sure your waivers are actually doing what you intend them to do.
All right, so next time you see a liability waiver, don't just blindly sign it. Take a second to think about what it really means.
Read it carefully. Ask questions if you need to.
Because as we've learned from Sweat v. Big Time Auto Racing, Those signatures don't always mean you've given up all your rights.
We're not always the get-out-of-jail-free cards that some companies might think they are.
Exactly. Well, this has been a fascinating deep dive. I really appreciate you breaking down all these complex legal issues.
Happy to be here. It's an important topic, and hopefully everyone listening has a better understanding of liability waivers now.
Definitely. So for everyone out there, think about what we've talked about today. When you encounter these waivers, what are the specific risks they're covering? And how can you be more informed about the agreements you're making?
It's all about understanding your rights and responsibilities.
Excellent advice. Thanks again for joining us.
Anytime.
And for everyone listening, until next time, stay curious and keep exploring the fascinating world of law.